Greetings, human or sentient object. It's the Nerdist Podcast number 336. This is a very exciting episode. I will get through the beginning part as quickly as possible so you can start jamming it into your ears to great delight. Doing a bunch of stand-up on the road starting the first week of April. I'm going to be in New York at Caroline's and then jumping all over the place to places like Portland and D.C. and Madison, Wisconsin, Baltimore, going to London. Going to be performing in London mid-May. I don't know the exact dates yet, but it's going to happen, and I will get to see if my references are too America-centric. So I don't think anything else airs over there that I do except for the podcast, so we will see if a podcast can draw some Brits out of their dwellings, am I saying that correctly, over to see me perform. And I'll put up all the tickets info for that, and dates for that will be at nerdist.com/calendar. I'd like to thank the Carbonite online backup for sponsoring this episode of the Nerdist Podcast. It's a really good idea to back up your information. Like, you would almost rather have, I would almost rather have my computer machine stolen as long as I could keep all my information. I'm not saying steal my computer. I'm not saying I just want it stolen. But if given the choice, if some sort of a weird, calculated super bandit was like, okay, I've trapped your computer and your information, and you can have one of them back. I'd be like, well, Super Bandit, please let me have the information. And he would say, great, you can have it in the form of Carbonite online backup. It turned out the Super Bandit was really trying to teach me a lesson about backing up. So in the end, I developed this weird Stockholm Syndrome, and then we end up living together for a while. It's a sordid tale. The important information is that you get your data back. Carbonite is plans start at $59 a year. You can access them from pretty much any machine. And then when disaster strikes, you get your stuff back. So Carbonite.com. Use the offer code Nerdist to get 2 free bonus months. I'd like to thank Carbonite for sponsoring this podcast, which is Lily Tomlin. I get excited about meeting people, but you just have to understand that Lily Tomlin comedically has meant the world to me. Grew up, you know, watching her stuff on Laugh-In and Ernestine and Edith Ann, and then 9 to 5. I swear to God, I saw that movie 150 times, and then All of Me, I think I saw twice as many times as that, which those movies both still totally hold up. So I was kind of nervous because I didn't know if I was going to lock up and just sit there the whole time and be like, you're cool. But she turned out to be so incredible and put everyone at ease and was just such a comfortable soul to be around. I absolutely cherished it. So Lily is in a Tina Fey movie that's opens the day this podcast comes out, March 22nd, called Admission. So if you can, go see it and support comedy movies with brilliant people in them. Here is the Nerdist Podcast episode. I'm going to hang out with her now all the time. She doesn't know this. I'm going to hang out. Lily Tomlin, if you're listening to this, I'm going to hang around you all the time. It'll be weird at first, but you'll grow into it. I'll bring you food. I'll be a neck pillow for you. You could just wrap me around your neck and take a nap on my soft rib meat. So here we go. The Nerdist Podcast number 336, celebrating my new companionship that she's not aware of yet with Lily Tomlin.
Now entering Nerdist.com.
We're recording.
Okay.
Welcome.
Thank you.
How are you, Lily Tomlin? It's nice to see you.
I'm good, Chris.
Pleased
to be here.
It is
with you.
An absolute pleasure to have you here on the podcast. Have you done any podcasts before? Is this your first podcast?
No, I think I've done a few.
You have?
Yeah. What's the difference between podcast and, an interview that's played on the internet? Is there a difference?
No, probably not really. Probably not really. It's basically, it's a little more long form and it's just sort of conversational and, you know, it's not, I mean, you're doing a ton of press for the movie that's coming out Friday.
Right.
How do you handle the 5 minutes, like, talk show interviews?
That's rough. Yeah, I agree with you. I never have liked it. And then especially if you get an interviewer who's like a little bit stiff and they kind of don't know what they're asking you anyway because they haven't probably seen anything.
Right.
And that's always hard. And I try to, before I used to just be like stunned that it was over. And in the old days, they started with the really short segments. Because you really don't get to say anything, and it's kind of lame, you know, very cut, sharp.
I love you. You and Ferguson are great together, though.
Oh, I love Craig. I'm going to do him in a few weeks.
You are going to do Craig in a few weeks? Because he's a guy that just, like, he throws the notes away.
He's so darn funny. Why, he's just so quick. You don't have to do anything. You just listen to him.
Yeah.
And kind of just react to him.
I remember the last time I saw you on a show, which I think was last fall, he said, oh, you look very nice today. And you're like, did I not look nice last time? And he goes, no, I just... you go, what was I wearing? And he's like, it was an outfit. I don't remember.
No, he just goes. I know. You don't... I love it because you don't pre-interview or anything.
Yeah, no, because he doesn't...
because on shows where you do a big old pre-interview...
the cough button. Someone finally used the cough button properly.
I'm so professional. So the... that you just when you go on a show that does a pre-interview, I never know what they're trying to get me to say. I can't remember what I told them when I had the pre-interview.
Yeah.
And then they cut it. They bring it down to something. They reduce it to something that they think the host will relate to or pick up on. And I can't figure out what the heck it is.
How many? You must have done Carson. You did Carson.
Oh, sure. I did Carson.
Were there pre-interviews for the Carson show?
Oh, yeah.
How measure was
well,
he?
Well, they just kind of, what are you going to talk about? But then Johnny wants to be kind of loose and on his own in a certain way, so it would bear no resemblance. I was fine. I'd rather just talk anyway. I just free associate and go. But so when they're really trying to get you to say something, you raised pumpkins, didn't you? and maybe you told him some story about, you know, throwing a pumpkin down on your kid brother or something. You don't know what they're trying to get you to say.
Yeah, and the bad trick is always, someone told me one, I heard somewhere that, where did you hear that? From the guy fucking preparing the interview?
Yeah, exactly.
You didn't That's just hear that in the world. But it's, you know, I think with Craig in particular, I think the format forced him to go rogue because the idea of doing, he's like a punk rock background. He was like in punk bands.
Yeah, no, he's very free.
So the idea of having to do the same thing every day, it's like, I think it was the only way he could deal with it. And the result was a great show.
Yeah, I think if he had to do that, it'd have to shut him down a little bit.
Yeah.
Because he's just flying.
Yeah, that's doing a show every night and having to be present every night and be entertaining in like 6 minute chunks. Did you ever want to do that kind of a talk show? Ever?
No, I don't think I ever would have been too good unless they'd let us like and you know Dinah Shore used to have a talk show here.
Yeah,
for a long time it was pretty successful back, but that would be in the 70s or something. And they used to get everybody loaded. I mean, there would be wine in your dressing room, wine in the coffee cups. You know, the coffee cups are sitting there. It's all wine. I was on once with Robert Blake.
Uh-huh.
Oh, I've been on with a bunch of them. And after a while, I've got an old tape where you just want me to shut up. You're thinking, because they started framing me out of the shot because I wouldn't stop talking.
Really? Were you hammered?
No, I was loaded, yeah. And you'd hear everything. They'd say, like David Niven was on, and he started talking about doing something with like Marlon Brando or someone and they would just make each other crack up or something. And he'd say, oh, and we'd break up. And you can feel the energy coming from off the screen. And it's me. And you know, I'm saying to myself, please don't say anything, please. And you hear me pipe in more than Sonny Bono.
Get off it.
Yeah, just I couldn't stop it.
Well, you get the comic genes, so you can't stop that.
Well, I don't know if that's even comic genes. I think that was just like, you know, impulsive compulsivity or something.
Well, there was that whole, I lived in the 70s, and I remember there basically was a talk show circuit, like a really intense talk show circuit. And I remember seeing people going, I don't even know if I've seen them do anything else other than just appear on all the talk shows.
Well, some of them were real pop. Yeah, they were regulars, like regulars on a talk show.
Yeah.
And they would appear, or they would appear frequently on the same show. I mean, just like Grodin or Smokey the Bandit. But
Oh, Burt Reynolds, yeah.
Burt Reynolds was on Carson a lot.
Yeah, and Dom DeLuise would come out and they'd hit each other in the crotch with pies.
Yeah.
It was a...
And before that, like on Par in Places, there were all the people that had like a persona, you know, like Wally Cox or Hermione Gingold or Dodie Goodman or Renee Taylor. And they all, when they sat down, he had a certain way of talking and everybody thought it was really funny and they'd laugh. And Genevieve was French and she would have fractured French, English, you know, like, oh, I love the applause. I love the applause. And of course, the audience is just screaming and laughing and loving it. And Hans Conried and Myron Cohen, people who had like a kind of personal shtick that they did.
Like they just had one character that they would be known as.
Well, yeah, and so different people would say to me when I'd go up to be on a show, they'd say, God, it's too big. You know, like I did all these characters. People are going to get confused. They're not going to know who you are. And I said, too bad you're so normal when you're talking.
Do you like... Because you seem you seem to have no problem just being conversational, but you also drift into characters if you want. And I feel like some people usually pick one or the other. They're characters because they can't be themselves. But you.
I never felt I had that. I always felt the characters were just it was more varied. I wanted that variety, you know, just to do one. Plenty of people are hilariously funny and I'm fans of many people. But I was always attracted to character because I guess I grew up with so many, and they were funny or sad or hilarious or tragic or mean or good, and it was really kind of falling in love with that whole range of humanity.
Yeah,
and knowing that we weren't so different, we looked or sounded differently, but we weren't really.
And do you because you know you've done a ton of characters that you've really just done one time. Like for a show, like for Search for Intelligent Life, Science of Intelligent Life, but then other characters that people know that you did, you know, that you
recur,
did a lot
right?
That recur, like Edith Ann or Ernestine or these characters. So do you like disposable characters or do you really like going back and doing the same?
No, if I can find something relevant for them to say or be, then they're all like a little. It's I've said this before, but it's like Mrs. Duggar, you know, with the 19 kids,
right?
You know, you don't really have a favorite. It would be cruel to say, you know, I like number 6, but I cannot stand number 4.
19 and counting.
Yeah, right.
And count. I think they might be up to 20 now. But when did you start? You started doing stand-up, right?
It was always characters, but I would get up and stand there and do it and force people to pay attention or try to force them to pay attention. I would go on. It was just a way. I guess it's partly my family. My mother and dad were Southern. But I grew up and lived in inner city Detroit, mm-hmm. and then every summer I'd go to rural Kentucky, and I lived in a predominantly black neighborhood. I just had so many different people. Old apartment house filled with, you know, old professionals who couldn't move because they had earned fixed incomes, and my mother and dad, you know, blue-collar Southerners coming up to the city to work. And it's rich. It's really juicy.
And where did you start performing? Did you go to New York?
I put on shows all the time. I had any show business in my family, or I never went to the theater, but I took ballet and tap at the Department of Parks and Recreation, which was a big program directly across the street from my apartment house that kept kids off the streets, you know, with programs.
It
totally worked. I loved it. I've loved it more than God. And I put on shows and I try to sell tickets and I try to get other kids to be in the show. But it never occurred to me to do that, that you could do that for a living.
And then when was that moment?
I started college. So I was, when I say this, it sounds in my mouth, it sounds pretentious because I went into pre-med and I never could have been a doctor. Never, ever, 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 ever. I couldn't, if I opened a textbook, I would get like, you know, textbook narcolepsy and my head would fall to the page and I'd wake up the next morning, 6 o'clock and I hadn't studied. I hadn't done anything. So, but I was in college and I got in a college show and I made a big hit just off the cuff, you know, and all the kids who were in drama, they'd come out and say, oh, do you know what kind of concentration you have and stuff like that? And I thought, no, it was fun, you know, it was like playing. So then I began to really take it. I thought I would try to make it a living doing it.
Yeah. And then at what time did you start going up on stage after that? Was this in the late 60s?
Well, a coffee house in Detroit. I started working at a coffee house in Detroit. This is back in the early 60s. So, you know, in those days they had, they'd have theater. Somebody would be doing a play, you know, some of the kids would be doing a play. And then we'd have after theater and sketches and folk singing and poetry readings. And then after hours we'd have jazz. I mean, it was an all service, all the time coffee house.
Oh, wow.
It was great.
That sounds like
great.
And culturally, what an amazing time to be. You know, that's like right, especially in the 60s, where people are starting to sort of break out of that post-war era. Everything's all buttoned up and uptight. You know, like it sounds like things seem to be more.
And the comedy was all, you know, earlier it would be, you know, it was all mostly men. Very few women did comedy unless they had a show like they were a movie actress that was like Gracie Allen or Joan Davis or someone like that. Or then, of course, Lucy was on in the 50s, but there still were a handful of women doing comedy.
Yeah.
And very few did stand-up. Jean Carroll was one of the very first stand-ups. She would be on Ed Sullivan back in like the late, like 49 or 50. And I used to watch her with my mother, and she was very subversive in a way that as subversive as you could be, I guess, in 1951 or something. She was very attractive, and she always wore a cocktail dress, and she was very breezy, and she'd tell husband jokes.
Oh, that's kind of messed up, because that still makes it about men in a weird way.
Yeah, well, I guess, yeah, but she still, I knew my mother would like, I was just a little kid, and I would, but my mother enjoyed it so much. And she'd also talk about her kids, you know, and she'd always, like, as a little subtext, she'd say, my daughter, rotten kid. You know, so she did things that, you know, Beaver's mother would not do.
Of course not, yes. So when you started doing these performance pieces in the early 60s, what was the nature of your material?
Characters. I would talk, too. But I would do a lot of characters I made up in that time. They still play. I mean, monologues. Because they were just timeless. I used to do a woman at a funeral. She would use the deceased as a ventriloquist dummy to cheer up the widow. And, I mean, that was one of my favorites at that time. But I also did things like The Rubber Freak, which I was a woman addicted to eating rubber objects. And it was really kind of a confessional, like an AA confessional.
Oh, right.
But in my own mind, the purpose of it was the hypocrisy of what's an acceptable addiction or an acceptable substance and what is not.
That's really fun. Do you intend, because especially, you know, the piece that I remember from, I think about it a lot, is the piece from Search for Intelligent Signs of Intelligent Life, where it's the two prostitutes get in the car.
Oh, yeah.
And it's like, oh, we're being interviewed again. Like that whole thing. But there's really like a nice social commentary underneath that.
Yeah, hopefully.
Other than just being a character.
Yeah, no, because you want to fill their lives. So, and their lives are more than, you know, if you're going to essence it in a certain 3 or 4 or 5 minutes or whatever, you've got to tell something really the belly of it. Some part of it to make the character live and not just be throwing out jokes.
So is that, do you feel like that's one of the cornerstones of comedy is to have it be humanizing in some way? Or
yeah, humanizing.
Yeah.
You said it. That's what would be meaningful to me is like somehow so the audience will identify with, they don't look at them as something separate and just, you know, you create their life in some way. So even someone like Ernestine is broad and Ernestine is filled with puns and things. In fact, when I first saw Ernestine on the screen, when I went to Laugh-In, I was on the 5 o'clock feed. I was in New York and on a Monday night when Laugh-In used to air. And I looked at I had never seen Ernestine visually. And because I taped for about 6 weeks before we went on the air, I had brought her to the show, but I'd never dressed her. I dressed her at Laugh-In. I went in the costume room and dressed her, and I knew what her hair looked like. I had a wig built and everything, but so when I saw her, I thought, oh no, she's going to be too broad. And then I kept watching, and I thought, no, there's something she's something true about her, something real about her, and it, you know, just connects. So she's funny as a person, and then she has such a definite point of view, and a lot of it is self-involvement, but she was able to do a lot of political stuff in the course of it, because as a minion of Ma Bell, she could talk to anybody in the world, tape their conversations, threaten them.
Well, yeah, and also because, you know, because she was sort of physically was very much a caricature, I feel like it's almost like watching a cartoon in the sense that you can sort of like Family Guy, like why I think, you know, Seth MacFarlane as a person, as just like a rich white guy, might not be able to say some stuff, but a cartoon baby can say stuff.
Oh, yeah, for sure.
So as a caricature, it just seems to totally free you up to be able to say things that you as Lily Tomlin, people be like, what's her problem? You know, but like you can make this commentary through these characters.
Yeah, no, that's another asset to taking that form.
But I think that's sort of the fun part of...
But you're right. See, that's what I thought when I looked at it. First time I thought she looked cartoonish because she's so strong, so graphically strong. Her jewelry's even strong, you know, the black jewelry with white dots on it. And but she turned out to be perfectly good.
Well, yeah. And then just the idea that you can see a character for 4 minutes and then go... I feel like I need to know everything. Like, you understand a lot about the character that's not right on the page, but you want to understand even more. Like, what would you want to do, like, a really long-form piece with that character, or do you just, like, small?
Well, it's so funny, because Mervyn LeRoy was still alive, and he had George Schlatter or one of the producers at Laugh-In take me out to his house because he wanted to do a Walter Mitty with Ernestine. But I was so... adamantly against exploiting any character. You know, I didn't want to be known as Ernestine exclusively. I wanted Ernestine to just be one of the characters I did. And it would be just like, I felt it would be, I didn't want to do it. Now in retrospect, I think, I wonder if it would have been great. And Mervyn LeRoy, I mean, it would have been fun to, I had a chance once to work with, now I forget his name, you know, the one who did Manchurian Candidate, old one, and the original one, I mean. And the black and white was Frank Sinatra. And I didn't, he wanted me to do a crypt keeper with him, but I had to stab somebody on camera, you know, viciously, stab them a lot. And I could not do it. I don't mind them saying I stabbed them and they're lying there dead.
But you don't
so
want
I'm
to
really
actually
a hypocrite,
do it.
But I just couldn't imagine myself, the arm coming down and stabbing somebody, you know, and blood squirting out or whatever.
It's too bad they wouldn't just let you, like, frame off your head and just go, and just with words go, I can't believe how much I'm stabbing this guy. I am really stabbing this guy
anyway,
a lot.
I was sick with myself that I, you know, that I passed up the chance to work with him, too. Because life passes,
but I'm
still here, and I didn't do it.
I think, but at the time, if you weren't in the headspace of doing it, then it's probably better that you didn't do it, because, you know, you wouldn't have.
No, I wouldn't have done a good job for him. I would have been.
These guys behind you are Matt and Jonah. They're usually on the podcast.
Nice to see you.
Were waiting patiently outside. I think they were afraid to come in because they didn't want to interrupt. Don't worry. Yeah, come up. Come pull up a mic. Sit down.
I wish we had chairs for you.
Yeah. No, you sit. No, you can sit. You sit.
The lady stays in her chair.
Yeah.
Haven't you learned anything from Rosa?
This is Jonah, and this is Matt.
Jonah, hi. Hi.
Hi. How are you?
I'm really good.
We didn't want to interrupt you because you're mid-story, and we're like, we cannot interrupt her.
I know, but I didn't want you guys to have the opportunity to not come in and just like you stood out the side the whole time.
Well, we tried. We didn't want to leave. We didn't want to be like, oh, we're leaving.
So these are just details. Nice to meet you.
Anyway.
Nice to meet you, Jonah.
So one of the things that I think was sort of an interesting point is that, maybe I'm wrong about this, but being sort of a product of the 60s comedy-wise, you're seeing a lot of comedy that's more social, that's more about what's going on in the world. I feel like what I see a lot of in comedy now, and I'm guilty of it too, is it's very selfish. It's like, me, 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 me. This is all about me, 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 me. And the 60s comedy seems to be about us as a people. This is the shit that's going on.
Yeah, that must have been where I got that from. I thought it up.
Maybe you did.
Not likely.
Who did you... I don't think... We were talking about talk shows before. I think attention spans... Well, maybe they're getting better now, but I think that sort of, you know, we have 5 minutes to talk. It's unfortunate that that's what talk shows end up becoming because, you know, Merv Griffin, Dinah Shore, Dick Cavett. Did you do the Dick Cavett show?
Yes.
How was Dick?
Oh, that was, well, I had a big episode on one of the Cavett shows because I was out promoting my second album, and my first album had won an Emmy or Grammy. You get Grammys, right?
Yeah, yeah.
And won a Grammy, and it was the first comedy album produced by a woman that had won. My manager at that time, Irene Penn, was my manager, and she had, so she got an Emmy too. And so I come on the show, and this is 1972. I was just going to play Carnegie Hall. I think I was promoting that too. You promoted everything in the day. So, and Dick says to me, I wanted to bring up the album, you know, so I wanted to give a nod to Irene. So, well, this is such a long story,
it's a good
story. I just remembered everything because in the green room is W.H. Auden, the poet. And Irene is English, and Auden's sitting in there like a big rump, you know, stained leather pillow. And he doesn't know who from Adam any of these people are. And Chad Everett was on with me that same night. And we went to the same college in Detroit, but I didn't know him there. But he was I was on, and then he was going to be on. So while I was on, Dick started this whole feminist thing, saying, when I said about the comedy album, he said, well, why not? Women are getting funnier every day.
Oh, no.
And so there's people, women in the audience, they go, they start hissing, you know. And then the next, I can't remember what else happened, but a bunch of stuff. And then Chad came out. And Chad was really popular in Medical Center. He was a big TV star.
Sexy guy.
And very, very popular. Had a huge TV queue, I imagine. So as he's talking, he says to Dick something about, Dick says, you have a ranch, you have horses or something. He says, oh, I have horses and I have this. And he says, but my wife is the most valuable animal I own.
Oh, Jesus Christ. So the 70s.
So by this time, there had been so much had gone on all week. I've been doing publicity like that. And I mean, I had gotten one thing after another and one show after another. Like on Mike Douglas one morning, the head of Scotland Yard was on this great English guy, and I said, are there any women inspectors? This goes, no, this is a long time ago, 40 years ago or more. I said, and he said, no, and I hope there never will be. Oh. Jesus. Well, he says, and as far as I go or something, and I said, well, could we leave the possibility open? So things like that have been happening. So when Chad says, the most valuable animal I own, I don't know why. I just got up. It was totally visceral. And I just said, I got to go.
Whoa.
And
that's it.
Yeah, and I walked off backstage, you know. And I suddenly thought, well, heck, I'm backstage. And everybody started grabbing me and saying, "Don't you can't do that to Chad. You go back out there. Don't you. And so
you can't do that to Chad.
Yeah.
That's ridiculous.
Embarrass him. So,
embarrass that 70s mustache.
So whatever happened, I don't remember all of it yet now, but...
You know, the sad thing is he probably thought it was a compliment.
Well, yeah. No, the best part, I'm leaving the best part out, see. So then he brings up Pageant Magazine, where he'd written a poem to Shelby, his wife. And Shelby, if you're hearing this, you know that I was always terribly fond of you. And and this was just a thing of circumstance. But anyway, Chad reads a poem from Pageant Magazine that he had written about Shelby. And here's W.H. Auden sitting in the green room. And my manager, Irene, is also very English and very offended at everything. And Auden says, in her presence, I'm not there because I've gone to my dressing room. And Auden says, who are those disgusting people? And Irene jumps up and she says, I've never been in such rude company. And she storms out.
Did Dick say anything after the show? Was he mortified?
No. Oh, God, no. They just think you're a nutcase, you know.
Really?
You're the 70s, trouble. Back when people hissed in audiences.
Yeah.
And kids would pass me on the street, and they loved it. You know, young people like it when you misbehave. And But some guy, kids would say to me, my mom says she's never going to watch you again because of what you did to Chad.
Jesus. it feels to
me. But God love me, he's gone now, you know.
Yeah.
Take that, Chad.
He lost.
You're dead.
They brought that up, and they brought it up, too, all those years later. He just died in the past year or so. But no, they didn't have any fun with it at all. They took it pretty seriously.
Well, I wonder, was it kind of irritating?
Oh, you just said, and that all came out of you asked me, did I ever do Cabot?
Yeah, that's a good story. But I almost wonder, you know, was there a burden on you in the sense that people were like, oh, she's the feminist comedian, so like everyone, because it almost seems like an air of condescension, like, hey, this feminist thing you got going on, what's that about really? Well, at a certain point, are you fucking kidding me?
You're exactly right. It's perfect. Even Toadie, I was on Merv Griffin one night with Toadie, and Toadie's up there talking. First of all, I had a piece of jewelry on. It had a plastic, and it was a plexi square.
Uh-huh.
and it had liquid in it, had kind of amber liquid in it. Tony says, she grabs a hold, she says, "What is that, urine specimen?" So, and then she gets up later and she's, you know, she's married and had children and everything like that, but she was a big Vegas comic. So, you know, she wasn't home making mac and cheese all the time.
Yeah.
And so she gets up and she starts walking down because she'd get a real pontificating at some point. And she says, "I wish I had a clip of this. Damn it, I'm so mad I don't have that video because I have a lot of it." And she goes down front and she says, "If women would just stay home like they're supposed to, we wouldn't have all this juvenile delinquency and this and that and this and that." You know, and she said, "And so, and the women should just stay home and..." Forgive me, Lily, what I'm saying. She turns around and does that to me. Oh, it's all so damn funny that you just want to scream.
But it's, I mean, I do remember that. I was young, but I do remember that period of, like, women's lib jokes.
Oh, and they'd always get, you know, they'd try to get the most, you know, uncomely kind of person on that they could. You know,
oh, right.
Not really, they wouldn't let them anchor the news, let's say that.
Right, right, right.
So, and it was always that way. Yeah, it was the butt of the joke.
Oh, man.
For a long time.
But even so, with a movie like 9 to 5, which I've seen probably 200 times, I've seen that movie. And Dabney Coleman was the perfect.
Oh, and I got my partner Jane, I got Dabney cast in that role because we loved him so much.
Really? Where did you find him?
Well, we see him on Fernwood at night.
Oh, yeah.
And he's such a sexy scoundrel. You know, he's like, there's something sexy about Dabney, and he's just sleazy, you know, but he's sleazy, but you just sort of love him.
Well, but particularly in that movie, like that really was a statement. That movie was a statement.
Yeah, and Jane Fonda set out to do that deliberately, you know. I mean, she started meeting what they, in fact, they formed the 9 to 5 organization after that, you know, to advance women's rights in the workplace and so on.
Yeah. And were you super involved with the writing and the creation?
No, because Colin Higgins wrote that screenplay. And he had done, you know, I'd known Colin from Harold and Maude from years before,
yeah,
of which I was a huge fan. And of course, Colin died not too long after the movie was finished. And we tried for 20 years to do a sequel with Dolly and Jane and me. And of course, now we're all too old to do it. You know, we'd have to be the mothers of...
Now what happened?
Wait, they're sequel crazy right now. So just go ahead and pitch it.
Yeah, I think it'd be fun. Yeah.
Anyway, so
I just don't want them to try to make the sequels without you guys. And I'm glad that someone hasn't gone crazy now and been like, "We need to make All of Me the sequel." Like, that's just one of those.
They're going
to
do all.
We'll call it 10 to 6.
No, wait. No, stop, Matt. She just was about to say something.
They are going
to
do All of Me. No. Somebody is. Yeah.
How's that? No.
A remake?
They've been planning on it for a long time.
They can't.
I know.
They can't do that. It was the perfect, just the way that it.
I know. Steve was so good. It was just so much fun.
Both of you. And you know, you look at these types of performances, and I complain about this in the podcast a lot, is that why is there not an Oscar for, like, that performance, those performances?
Well, he did win the New York Film Critics. Steve did. I mean, so that was good.
All right. That's somewhat comforting.
But it's not the Oscar. I agree.
I feel like it's so much harder to make people laugh for an hour and a half than it is to make them cry. Because everyone can... You know, like, you just tell a sad story, people are like, "Oh, wow, that's a bummer." But to embody, like, this split in half, the physicality, I mean.
No, I love that movie, too. And you know that whole back and bowl bit was ad-libbed.
Really?
Between Steve and Libertini.
Richard Libertini. Completely ad-libbed.
Completely.
People still say that today.
Oh, that's what people really take away. They really carry on about back and bold. Back and bold. They love that. Yeah, they really did.
Was it a fun movie to work on?
I love Steve. I feel, you know, this is how many years? That was 87 or something. 85. 85, I think it was. 80, something like that.
Yeah, 84, 85, I remember.
Yeah. So it was a long time ago, but... And Steve was, Victoria Tennant was in the movie, and Steve married Victoria.
Yeah.
And the first day we had a reading, I said to Steve, and I just felt a very deep affinity with Steve, and always have. I don't know why, but I do. And I feel kind of maternal toward him sometimes. You know, he always seemed lonely to me.
He seems...
He's not a, you know, on set, he's not a person who's... A lot of times you work with people, and they're on all the time. and they can't stop. If there's a piano, they have to sit down and play the piano and start singing. Yeah. And they just are on, you know, and trying to keep people entertained, I guess. And Steve's very quiet, very rather conservative in his behavior. Always smart as hell, but so anyway, so when we finished, we had lunch together, everybody, Carl and everybody, to get to know each other. And I could just sense something between them. And I said to Steve, we walked down the street, and I said, are you going to start dating Victoria? He said, no, I make a point of never dating my leading ladies or something like that.
I'll marry them.
I'm so glad he has it. Now he has a baby.
Now he's got a baby. Yeah.
I know.
Did she have the baby or is she pregnant?
She had a baby.
She had a boy. Oh, wow. Yeah, Steve, I mean, I was such a comedy nerd when I was growing up. So between, like, your comedy albums and your characters and Steve and Richard Pryor and just... Oh, you worked on the Richard... Didn't you work on...
Richard was on my first two specials because I was mad for Richard, of course, because he did characters and, of course, just who he was and how he did it. And I would see him at the Improv. He'd already gotten kind of famous. So when I got my first special on CBS, I went to Richard to try to get him to be a guest on it, but he kind of didn't really... You know, he probably didn't watch Laugh In that much. Or who knows what he was doing in those years. And so I put a set up at the Ice House to show him that I was not a square white girl he could work with. So I did a set at the Ice House, and then he made me go to a porno movie with him.
Oh my God, what?
And I said, okay, I'll go, but I'm paying my own way.
You went Dutch.
Yeah,
you do Dutch porno.
Right. And then we went down to the neighborhood, and of course, from Laughing, a lot of black folks knew me and liked me. So he saw everybody kind of knew who I was, and that was good in my favor, too. So I passed all the fire.
Wow.
And we became fairly friendly, you know, for a while.
Yeah.
I mean, we were always friendly. I also did his old Pryor's Place. I played Trudy the Bag Lady once.
Wow. Do you like television, or do you like film, or do you just... Do you like every medium as long as you can kind of do the character that is appropriate?
Yeah, I like to be able to do a little of everything.
Oh, that's fun.
I was at Richard's house the day Barry Gordy called him to tell him we were working on a bit for the special I was going to do next. And he and Barry Gordy told him he'd just seen a cut of Lady Sings the Blues and how good Richard was. And I don't know, the first time I ever saw Richard was on Ed Sullivan doing The Primps and the Princess and the kids having a play at school. Do you know that bit? Is that on one of his albums? It must be.
It was on a compilation of, I think, a bunch of his like TV
Anyway,
princes.
You know, I saw him and I thought, oh, who is this guy? He's so vulnerable. He's so wonderful. And he was doing just a very, you know, middle of the road kind of piece, a material, I mean, that could play to a Sullivan audience. But it was so... gives me goosebumps when I even mention it. And so when I saw, when Barry Gordy called him that, and I don't know Barry Gordy or anything, it sounds like I'm really in the mix. But Barry called him to tell him that, and he was on the, you know, he was having a hard time, then he'd been blackballed from Vegas or whatever. You know how he walked off or something. I don't know all the history. But Barry told him how great he was in that movie, and you could see Richard was just like that same kid doing The Primps and the Princess. Like, he was so... He was just like overcome, you know, with sort of joy, sweetness.
Oh, wow.
Yeah, it really was lovely.
Do you feel like did you feel a kinship in the sense, and I'm sorry if this is a really dumb middle of the road question, but was there sort of a kinship of you as a woman in comedy and Richard as a black man in comedy in that time, like breaking out of traditional boxes of the entertainment industry?
There might have been, you know, I mean, I think the characters would be something that we did a cover, a Rolling Stone cover. I don't know what year that was. We did a combo, you know, we were on the cover together. And then that whole writing, it was David, what's his name? You know who he is if I said his name. But he did this huge story on Richard, and then the next week it was a story on me. Was it weekly or monthly?
Rolling Stone was weekly.
Yeah.
Yeah.
So I have a big Rolling Stone cover with Richard and me, and he's doing comedy like Satanic, and I'm, you know, comedy mask, and I'm doing a trend naturally.
Are you a generally happy type of a comedy person? Or I mean, just the idea of, like, you know, when you think of comics being tortured, or it's like, oh, they're so, You know, are you generally a pretty easygoing, happy person?
I think so. Paul could probably tell you better than I can. I'm kind of moody and temperamental, too, but not because I've had a tragic life, just because I'm mean and have a streak of, you know, moroseness in me.
Do you think that's true?
Because I know we're all going to die, and I look at you and I don't even want to think about it.
Oh, no.
I love that when Steve used to come out and say, you're all so upbeat for a crowd that's eventually going to all be dead. Whatever he'd say.
And then he'd put the arrow on the head. Did you watch a lot of live comedy when you were coming? Did you like watching comedy as well?
Sure. I don't go out to the clubs or anything like I should, you know, but I don't.
I mean, you can go down so many great...
There's so many great people. I mean, there's people I really think are really good. I mean, but they're usually character that I'm at first attracted to. Because if I see somebody, I think, oh, why didn't I do that culture type? You know, I mean, Catherine O'Hara, I loved her when she was on SNL. I mean, on...
SCTV.
Yeah. I love Wanda. Wanda just does straight stand-up, Wanda Sykes, but she's very funny. Elaine Boozler was brilliant, and Elaine never got the real credit she, I think, deserved.
Well, she was right in the middle of the comedy boom of the 80s when there were so many comedians on every channel. There were so many great comics that I feel like...
They got overlooked. Rick Overton is brilliant.
Rick Overton, definitely.
There's so many people that, I feel guilty that I came along that decade before them and the field was so bare, especially where women are concerned, you know, that I just had, it wasn't that hard to stand out or to be seen because there were just so few of us.
I guess that's one way to look at it, but I think the other way to look at it is that because there were so few spots, I guess, that you were vying for, that you had to be really good to stick out. I mean, I feel like that's, now anyone can do everything. And so there's so much noise that it's about rising above that noise instead of just vying for those handful of spots.
And even when every radio show has got, you know, thinks they're going to, you know, like Rush, or every news show, they got to have some comedy, even to the extent that, you know, the mainstream TV ones play clips from The Tonight Show and from, you know, from everybody, Leno and Conan and whomever, they'll play little political bits.
Yeah.
It's like it's just rampant, you know.
We are completely inundated now. Are you overwhelmed by the amount of media today?
No, media. Definitely I'm overwhelmed by media and knowledge.
I really feel like our brains are not evolved to process
that much stuff
at all.
We need a chip. We need something to help us.
Do you feel like people in general, because now, you know, there's...
Plus you take into account the disinformation and the lies.
Oh,
and
sure.
The misperceptions and misconceptions and, well, I mean, you're just like, you know, beef jerky.
Well, that's overwhelming. I mean, like to the extent where you have to pick a news source that is congruent with your beliefs because they have their own points of view. They're not just delivering the news. Everything's so much... It goes through a filter, so how do you even know what to believe? Do you feel like when you were doing comedy in the 60s and the 70s, was there as much depression and anxiety and stress as there is now? Or because I feel like everyone I know
in society, you mean?
Yeah. Or was but because we were being less inundated? But I mean, I almost wonder.
I think we could get a handle on it a little easier. I think you know there. First of all, we had three television stations just to begin with. That'll cut things back quite a bit.
Yeah, yeah.
And the internet, everything that we have now is just with the internet, and it's just a barrage of stuff that before you can even see it, it's gone.
Yeah.
I don't think things. Well, let's see. The Vietnam War was on, I mean, it didn't end until 73, and we had Nixon. We had certain things
You had Nixon.
Useful to comedy, but not like today. And you're right. You don't even, where do you come down on which side of what and how much shelf life does it even have? It has like 24 hours, maybe.
Yeah. Yeah. And people are used to disposable, like even the idea of listening. I mean, I listened to comedy albums hundreds of times when I was growing up. And I feel like now people just listen to something once and they go, I got it. What's next?
Yeah.
Like we're like locusts. We're just like these mental locusts with in completely insatiable appetites.
Well, I think that's true. I think the demand to stay on top of every little thing. I rely on Paul a lot. It seems like Paul, he seems to know 20 times more than I know. He's forever, you know, seeing something on Facebook or on the internet. And I think I'm there all the time looking, and he sees things. He'll say to me, did you see what so-and-so said? And like the other night, we went to Bill Maher's show just to, you know, I'd never been to it live to see it.
Yeah.
And Rachel Maddow was on, and she had a great line. But it's gone like that. And I thought, oh, if I thought of that line, damn it. It's so good. And the line was, she was talking about Portman coming out and saying, because he knows his son is gay, now he's for gay rights or same-sex right. marriage or whatever. And she said, I wish he had awakened one morning and found his son was poor.
Oh, shit.
Isn't that a great joke? Great. Yeah.
That's great.
Hey, Jonah, back away from
that
a little bit.
I'm hearing your... Nobody even mentions it. They never mentioned it the next day. I said to someone on the show, I said, why don't you spotlight like the best line of the night or something? You know, have a little category on the internet.
Yeah. Do you have a, are you on social media or anything?
Yeah, I have all of it, but I don't really do much.
It's another job. It's another damn job.
I do a show on ABC, so I tweeted. Yeah. I tweeted one night. Well, you can't even keep up with it. My God! And all I wound up doing was, you know, inviting people to concerts.
Well, it's funny, you know. It's like you know, you say that line gets lost, but you know, it's exactly how Twitter works. It's just it really is a stream.
I couldn't even get back to the person. There'd be eight more, you know. And I'm doing.
Oh, that was really funny. Oh shit, that was a thing. Oh, that's like, oh, I'm that. And then you just ball up, and then you're just like, getting caught in the LA River. You're just totally overwhelmed. Do you want to do live performing again?
Do it all the time. I just played San Diego a couple weeks ago. This year I haven't done as many dates as I normally do because I was doing that Reba show on ABC. But I usually try to do 40, 50 dates a year.
Oh my God. Well, where is there a place people can go just to find out?
Well, on my website, I guess they post it all the time.
Are you lilytomlin.com?
Yeah.
Okay, good. Good, good, good. I want to see you live. I hope you do more shows this year so I can come see you live. Are you, what?
No, I was just...
He's laughing. I started to say, and when I looked at him, I started to say, I'm a nice girl.
I saw a clip of you talking to Rosie. And I like just how sort of you're very just matter of fact about stuff. Like you just talk about stuff very openly. And with her, you know, she was asking a lot of questions that I feel like a lot of people could be like, well, I don't. And you were like, yeah, this is how, you know, like my mom was this and, you know, growing up being gay was this. And when I met Jane, and it was just very kind of comfortable.
Yeah.
Have you always been that comfortable?
There's a lot of progress has been made in this area. And back in the 70s, I mean, this is not news either, but I was working on my Modern Scream album in the studio with Jane in 75, and Time called my publicist called and said that Time would give me the cover if I'd come out. And I said... And I thought that was, you know, it's not because they were going to do it because of my work.
Right.
But I was kind of, first of all, it's very dicey in the 70s if I had come out in a big way. I mean, I felt I was out, but I was never, I never had a press conference. I never called people and said, now I have a big announcement to make. I remember seeing a cartoon like in the New Yorker or something where some guy's come, he says, I have to announce it. I'm not gay. it was like a spin. It was quite a few years ago, but it was a spin on that time. So when we did the album, because I declined to do it finally. I thought of it. I tortured over it because I thought, well, politically, it would be really great to do that. But of course, it would be the end of my career probably for 10, 15 years.
Oh, no.
I would. I didn't do it. I didn't accept it. And also, I felt a little bit bought, you know, like, well, we'll give you the cover if you... You know, tell us about your personal life.
Right, and especially that it had nothing to do, it wasn't about your work.
No, that's what I'm saying. And later, if you look, it was September of 75, I forget which issue, but they used Matlevich, the serviceman, you know, the U.S. Army or whatever he was in. So they just needed a gay person.
Yeah.
Oh, geez.
They had the font picked out and everything. Yeah, everything. We're just waiting. We're just
a blank name.
We're going to drop that name in.
Yeah. Yeah. And then just a photo of just a question mark over. Yeah.
But so when we did our, so we put a bit on that album, which you could play some. Do you ever play? You play bits, don't you?
We can, absolutely.
No, you don't have to play it now. Except, so we did the thing, you know, we did a whole thing about, because I had just done Nashville, mm-hmm. and it was the first movie, and the album is all about being interviewed for a fan magazine, like Modern Screen, only we called it Modern Scream.
Yes.
So, and the interviewer says, you know, Lily, what was it like to see yourself up on the big screen making love to a man? And what we did is we just flipped all of Cliff Gorman's interviews from Boys in the Band,
uh-huh.
mostly, you know, where he says, you know, he was so worried about his career, as I'm sure it didn't do him any good ultimately, but to be playing a gay character in this gay-dominated film back in the early 70s. And he said, well, I've seen these men all my life. I know how they walk. So I say, I've seen these women all my life. I know how they walk. I know how they talk. And it goes on and on. You know, some people say I went too far. Some say I didn't go far enough. And on and on. And then the kick on it is, you know, you don't have to be one to play one.
That's
so. But nobody even picked up on it. Nobody said this. I thought was my big answer to Time Magazine.
You know, right.
I'll put this on my album, and they'll see that I'll do this on my own terms. And so nothing came of it. And in '77, we did get the cover of Time for our first Broadway show, but no, I didn't do it.
Is that sort of a weird? I mean. When your comedy has a certain kind of a thing that you're trying to say or message you're trying to say, and then some people miss that but focus on something else, you're like, no, that wasn't the thing. That was
I mean, that's been the story of my life. There's something about me that people I was on Irv Kupcinet's show in Chicago a few years back. Irv is dead now. This was in the 70s. And I was on with, there was a woman, a German doctor, who had written this very anti-female book, calling women parasites and all kinds of stuff. I thought it was a satire. And I said, this is a satire, right? No, it wasn't, you know. So I start talking from a feminist perspective, kind of arguing with her. And my aunt, I had an aunt who lived there, and she called me the next morning. She said, well, you sure gave that women's lib a good going over.
Oh,
jeez. And I said, Aunt Pearl, I was speaking for women's lib.
Oh, no.
And she's, oh, well, I must have got it mixed up. It's just that simple. So it's just like when I hitchhiked from Chicago, Detroit to Chicago, forget it, in December in a pair of ballet shoes when I was in high school. And in fact, one of the girls I hitchhiked with later became Henry Ford's widow, third wife and widow.
Oh, wow.
But they were music students, and I was in pre-nursing at that time in high school. And they all got expelled, but we went to such a big high school with so many curricula, the teachers didn't even know who I was. So I should have been dead in a gutter someplace, but somehow I always eluded the tyranny of physical harm.
And you sort of feel like maybe that there was a parallel with that, with your career too, do you think? That you
well,
always...
I'm saying nothing much ever came of anything. I think people, even in the early days, many, many journalists, and Jane and I would be together all the time, and no one ever wrote about us, even though we referenced each other all the time. And I think it's because in those days, they didn't write about you.
Yeah.
Personally. And if they did on occasion, they wouldn't if they had any kind of regard for you.
Yeah.
They thought they were protecting you.
Did you ever feel, do you feel responsibility, you know, because... like you said, you felt this responsibility. Maybe you should be on Time Magazine. Maybe you shouldn't be on Time Magazine.
Well, yeah, I did. I was torn about that, yes.
But did you...
Apparently, I wasn't courageous enough.
I don't know if it's the courageous thing. I think it was... The performer side of me understands that. Like, why can't it be about the work? Why does it have to be about... Why does it have to be about my personal life?
Yeah.
Why that doesn't have anything to do, you know... That to me seems like your comedy was all about that and that was the message you were making. And then it sort of makes sense, but it just sounds like they were just trying to sell magazines with a story.
Yeah, no, I think they had an idea about what was going on in the culture at that time and what they wanted to deal with it, and they were trying to think of ways to, you know, approach it.
What I read about how you guys met was that you saw like a special that she had done, and then you wanted her to write
for Edith.
What was the special that she did?
She'd written a thing. It was for CBS for after school program. It was the first thing she'd ever written because she wanted to be a songwriter initially. And she'd written and she, of course, as always, Jane has never done anything conventionally. So she had written this long, almost like an American Pie song, you know, went on for 10 minutes or something. And at that time, it was 1969 when she wrote it. I didn't see it until 71 because it was so well received. She won a Peabody for it, and they played it every year for about 25 years on CBS at Holiday. And it was about a kid in Harlem who befriends a stray cat and all that stuff. And she just got a lot of attention for it. So then I'd heard about it, and we had a lot of mutual friends, but eventually I saw, and it was called JT.
Okay.
And there was a book. Gordon Parks did the photographs. And so when I saw it, I was working on Edith, and I wanted Edith to be more than she was on Laugh-In. And I just, it was satiric, and it was tender, and it was funny, it was edgy, it was poetic, it was everything, you know, and the language was almost like aphorisms, and yet it seemed perfectly natural. And I thought, oh, this is so great. This would be so great for Edith. And I tried to get Jane to come and produce the album with me, you know, and this is just how she is, and she hasn't changed in all these years. She finally, I'm down to like a 12-hour wire before the recording truck's going to come into the ice house, and she sends me a whole bunch of paper. You can't even hardly read it. It's notated over here, and it's crossed out, and arrows going down, and I prevailed upon her. She came to L.A., and we produced the album together.
Oh, wow. What do you think she...
And I took a big leap artistically because of her.
So she gave you the perspective that you...
Well, she's just a very good writer. And empathetic. I mean, she's totally. We did share that same empathy we shared for life. We shared that empathy for all these different. She's from the South. She's from Tennessee, and my family's from Kentucky. So we had that in common anyway. And she'd gone to New York when she was about 17 because Morristown, Tennessee, wasn't any place where she would be likely to stay.
Sure.
And in fact, Dolly used to say, oh, we used to go to Morristown to get our teeth fixed. And, so it was all that.
So what do you feel like you learned about crafting characters or comedy? Like, what do you think?
Nothing. You just get a good idea or you don't, you know. Or you start working on something and it starts to live. Or like Ernestine, I started out, I didn't expect to be on TV. I thought I would just be around doing, you know, stage and I'd go to the improv or whatever to work on a bit. And I just thought she'd be like a tough New York operator in the early 60s. Everybody hated the phone company in New York because the phone service was terrible. The system was breaking down. And I learned later from the union, the communication workers union, that at that time, New York was letting the inner city just collapse because they were putting all their money into databasing and corporate, you know, probably just, really ramping up.
Mm-hmm.
And so we want, and then also we knew that AT&T, you know, assisted the government in wiretapping and
oh wow,
lots of stuff. So it was really ripe for satire. And I started doing her like a real tough Bronx operator and. Mm-hmm. But as I did it, it was just so organic. I can only say that is all that it can explain why that character was so struck such a nerve. Because as I talked, I got my face, everything happened physically. I got threatening people. It was like so sexual. Like she was just, and so she's drawing in on herself. I didn't know I was sticking my hand in my blouse and that my body was all corkscrewed up and it made my face tight. And then my face being tight made me snort. So it was just, I can point to that. And I thought, well, if I could come up with 10 more like that. That would be fantastic, but she was really organically born that way.
And do your characters, do they develop with a relationship with the audience? Are you testing stuff out, or do you just have a very solid idea?
I'm also persistent, you know, especially like when I was in, you know, in the last 10 years or more, I haven't done as much of that kind of thing. I used to have a storefront theater where I would leaflet, you know, I'd go to bookstores, we'd leaflet and just say, really tiny print, Lily reading new material, no props, no costumes, no actors, no refunds. And they'd have to call a number and do a fan quiz to get the address of the storefront, which was over on Heliotrope.
Oh, over, right. Yeah, right okay.
Over there near, I used to live in Los Feliz, so I had a storefront there.
Like Heliotrope and Melrose?
Yeah. Right, where Normandy and Melrose come together somewhere in there.
Yeah, there's still a couple theater friends over there. Yeah. Probably the same one.
Well, that Avery Schreiber Theater used to be near there, wasn't it? Or some theater.
Yeah, there's now a Moth and Fake. There's like, I think, three left in that strip.
Maybe they're using my old... I hung a whole bunch of lights and had a sound booth up, you know, because it's just a little narrow storefront. I only had 25 chairs in it.
Hmm. That's really smart, actually, because you can't... Because once you get really famous...
Yeah, you can't work anymore. People start writing about you.
They're like, why don't you do the bit that I saw on TV? You become sort of a puppet, I would imagine.
Yeah, that certainly happens.
Do Edith Ann, do Ernestine.
Yeah, who's Ernestine?
But I have to work on new material. I don't give a shit, dude. You know, I'm going to give you a new thing that's going to be like Ernestine, but it's a new thing. I don't have time for new things. I just need shit I already recognize.
Well, I worked on the search in that storefront, and people... I'm relating this to you saying, do you know what you're going to do so strongly or whatever?
Yeah.
I go by if the words are so well crafted or the idea is rich, then I'm bound to it no matter how much it fails.
Right.
You know, because I know it's there. I just can't find it. The character, I can't find the physical character, the voice and the body. And people would say, why don't you drop that? And who knows what the hell are you doing? And I'd just tell them, you know, to go screw, because I just knew it was good. I knew it would be good if I ever could crack it.
Yeah.
So that's where I'd have that little theater, and I'd just put on bits and, you know, do a little. And people would call up. They'd have to call up and answer a fan quiz. Real esoteric things.
That's really smart, though, because then everyone who's going is super invested. Like, they really... You make them work for it a little bit.
Yeah, so I'm once on Letterman, I think Tommy Valour appeared, and because I was publicizing one of my specials, and he announced to Marie that he was getting a divorce. Remember some guy announced? I think I predated that, frankly. Anyway, he was, and so nobody knew that Tommy, except somebody who saw Letterman, and if they were a fan, they would have tuned in.
Yeah,
and Tommy revealed that his wife's name was Marie. Now, Ludd's wife is named Marie, too, see? Ludd and Marie, who were supposed to be my parents. But so we'd say, who is Tommy? What's the name of Tommy Valour's wife?
Wow.
Oh, they'd be desperate to figure it out.
Well, now with the internet, they'd have it like that.
Yeah, I wouldn't use it now. I'm too smart for that.
And now you've given it away on the show, so everyone would know.
Other things, too, like what's Mrs. Beasley's children's names?
Oh, wow. Wow. And so you would get this collection of like 25 people who were super invested.
Hard won.
Yeah. And then did you, you worked out a lot of new stuff that way? It was just over and over again?
Yeah, especially I was working on The Search at that time. The Jane's play, The Search for Signs of Intelligent Life in the Universe. And I've got lots of videos from it and people standing up and saying, oh, I don't understand, what's the consciousness raising part? Because there was a big feminist, middle... A big feminist centerpiece in that play.
Yeah.
So something, and Post-its, people didn't know what Post-its were. They had just barely broken, and in fact, they were gonna buy the show for Showtime or HBO or whatever. And they said, could you change it to Stick'ems? Because Trudy the bag lady, you know, would write on Post-its and she'd stick them on herself.
Yeah.
Which isn't really possible because it won't stick that well to fabric.
But I like that they still got that note. Could you change this? What does it matter if it's Stick'ems or Post-its? At this point, do you still get notes about things, or do people just let you? Like for instance, when you go, you know, people, you were amazing. Like people loved you on West Wing, right? So do you, when you go in, I would imagine with Aaron Sorkin, though, it's probably
Aaron,
pretty much
Aaron,
like.
No. Aaron, could I change the or can I say hmm instead of well, I don't know. Let me hear. How are you going to do it?
Oh, jeez.
No, I'm exaggerating, but we didn't challenge Aaron too much.
No, I guess in that sense, that's pretty much like that show's inside his head.
Yeah, and so much of it was about policy and stuff. You had to be pretty accurate, you know.
Yeah.
Couldn't take off and do too much.
Did you ever challenge him on how fast you want to walk down the corridor? You're like, maybe I'll slow it down.
Just so you don't run over the dolly. Trip and fall down.
Do you prefer that, or do you like to be able to come in and riff?
Depends.
And-
no. It depends on what's there and what artists you're working with. I mean, you sometimes want to be running after them. They're taking you further ahead, yeah. Faster. Now, excuse me, I hope this isn't going on the airways, but I guess it is.
That's fine.
Some shows, I mean, generally you don't do them because you don't think the writing, you know, well, I'm not of that same mind. That's not going to work for me. But generally if I decide to take something, it's because I feel like somewhere I'm going to find something about myself or about that character that's going to be fun or rich to do.
Yeah. Was there a particular part that you learned a ton about yourself that you didn't expect?
Well, you know, when you work on the stage, that's why I think actors love to work in theater. Especially if you're doing rich material like The Search, which I'm playing 12 characters, and it's a wonderful, it's just beautifully done, and I know that if I do it well, the audience is just going to be validated and enriched,
yeah.
You know, and I'm going to, it's just, when I was doing The Search, I would just love to do it every night because it was like I had this secret gift I was going to give them, this play that valued them so highly that, and as collectively. So, I was saying why people like to work on the stage. Because every night you discover something, you have some new sense memory or you find a deeper place for it. Maybe something wears out, and so you find another reference or sense memory. This is when you're acting a role, you know, and doing. I'm not talking about coming out and just doing sketch comedy.
Sure.
Although you learn from that too, and eventually you get better, and you know, you do stuff. And
are you good at being done with stuff? Are you good?
No.
You're not. So you still go back. You go, oh, I should have done this.
Oh,
or,
oh yeah.
I should have had this.
Oh God, yeah. Beat yourself up all the way back to the dressing room, and. And then just, you know, this and angst over something you couldn't do or you didn't think of soon enough. Or the damn camera's turned around and they're not going to shoot your side again.
Oh, no. Yeah. You already came up with the...
And you just as the camera's moved, wait, don't take the camera away.
I was just riffing, reading for that person who had this close-up. That's not fair.
And then you figure out motivation for her to walk in the other camera.
Yeah.
You just
what
say...
What if I just win?
If I was that smart.
Yeah. You just say it really fast, you go by... Yeah, so do you, wow, so you do beat yourself up a little bit. Well, I'm sorry that you do that, but it's comforting because that is.
Oh, I think we all, I can't believe we don't all do it, especially if we like really love what we do or want to be, you know, just want to be, make it the best you can.
Yeah.
Whatever your work is.
Do you have sort of a performance mode or a focusing technique, or do you just like, let's just do it, I'll just get out there and do it?
Yeah, no. I don't have anything like that. Yeah, just get out there and do it.
Well, just try to, just the idea of, I for the long time I thought, oh, there's probably some place my brain has to go so that I will be in the mode of everything will just be right where I need it to be. And so I would experiment with different things like, I'll get super excited before the show, I'll get super relaxed before the show, I'll try to focus really hard, or I won't even think about the show. And what I've discovered is that none of that matters. Like some shows, I just...
Yeah, you just soar.
And then...
Come out and it's... I always think of it like a blind date, you know? I always think you go out and you want to really have a great date, but sometimes you just don't.
Yeah. And you just have to be okay with that.
Yeah.
Well,
I guess.
You're working with Tina Fey. How was Tina?
Well, that was great. I had to come to terms with the fact that I was not of her generation.
What do you mean?
I mean, I see the Paul and Tina. I think I'm their contemporary.
You are.
Well, you'd think so, but I'm not. Because they asked me about the day it really hit me was we sat down to eat lunch and they wanted to know about Shrinking Woman and 9 to 5.
Sure.
And I start thinking about it, and I realize they were like 10 years old or something when those movies came out. And well, I thought, oh, help
it,
me.
It is really yeah. hard to, like, I mean, those movies, 9 to 5, Shrinking Woman, Big Business.
Big Business, yeah.
I mean, you know, they just... I still have
kids, people who are grown now in their 30s or whatever, and however, and they all come shake their bracelet at me. You know. So all that stuff is great. I mean, it's very gratifying to have that connection. Like an old piece I used to do, you know, Lud and Marie meets Dracula's daughter about the cake. You know, please stop talking about that cake. Slam, the door slams. And kids would send me cakes backstage. So many kids would say to me, oh, Lily, you'll never know. They're grown up now. And they'd say, the cake piece, Lud and Marie got me through my, you know, junior high school or got me through high school. They'd have an old 8-track and they'd play it in their dad's car because they think they're the only ones who have parents who like Lud and Marie.
Well, I hope that you do feel like that you're a contemporary. You've just been working longer than they have.
I have been. You're absolutely right.
It's absolutely true. But, you know, like, I don't think we would have gotten Tina without you, you know?
Well, I don't know. I won't say that.
You can't say that, but I can say it. I mean, there's a whole generation of people that, you know.
But I have had some great kids as my offspring, talented. You know, Tina's, I mean, I played mothers, a lot of mothers now lately. And Tina's one of them, you know, and I'm pretty proud of her.
She's a mad woman. I don't know how, it's like, where, how do you do, how do you write, star in, produce that, you know, a show, a
and
single
raise
camera
two
show,
kids.
Raise two kids, then find the time to write movies, and then throw a best-selling book in there at the same time.
Yeah. How does she do it,
damn it? I have no idea. I maybe I'm projecting, but I automatically assume, like, there's no way she can be happy. How does she have time? Like, she must be just almost burdened by her own sense of genius of, like, I just have to get all of this out of me.
She's a robot.
I'm going to die.
She's a robot.
You think so?
Yeah.
She must be not
real. But her husband, she has a really cute husband. They seem really like a great couple. So,
are you a workaholic or are you pretty good with your schedule?
No, I don't know. Do you think I'm a workaholic? I don't want to work, but then I get pressed to work or something. Or plus I have to keep, you know, when you live a long time, you have to keep earning money.
That's true. you do have to keep earning money.
I mean, and I don't want to die. So, you know, I hope I live a really long time, but God, it's, you know, then you got to really go out and hustle the dollars.
That's true.
Well, how about giving me half of what you used to give me? That kind of thing. You have to, you know, because that's how it goes.
Yeah. Well, especially now that, you know, we're sort of coming out of the era of, like, here's $50 million to do a thing. Like, everyone's, you know, even when you do pilots now, they're like, no, they're pilot presentations, which just means we have less money. So it's a pilot.
And with the whole thing, what happened with SAG and everything and the unions, you know, the after contract, when you have to sign an after contract, it was pretty chintzy.
Yeah.
Yeah.
You know.
Yeah. Well, now the unions have...
Yeah. So we're hoping for...
Hopefully that's
they'll
helpful.
Get strength back.
But Admission is the movie with Tina Fey.
Right, right. And I play her mother, who is a notable feminist who wrote a notable book called The Masculine Myth. And I've tried to raise her in my own, you know, fancied image, you know, of this kind of Amazon, self-determining female, independent, extremely independent, powerful, empowered, you know, and I've probably done her a disservice. She probably wasn't exactly that.
Do you feel like now, like, do young women approach you online and they're like, what can you tell, like, what does it mean to be a feminist now, or what should I be focusing on, or what is it? You must get that question all the time.
No, I don't get, because most young women aren't even keyed into it. You know, in the movie, I have a tattoo of Bella on my upper shoulder here, my upper arm, and I did it because... I named my daughter Portia. That's Tina's name. And my dogs are named Betty and Gloria. So I wanted to have a tattoo of Bella because, you know, young women don't know who Bella is. And so, Bella was, I was really devoted to Bella. In fact, it was so funny because Marlo and I, Marlo Thomas and I would go out, and this is way back, and we'd go, like, to when she was going to run for Congress, and she was going to run out of Westchester, and we'd go up there and try to get a crowd in a neighborhood, you know, because we were both on TV then, or well known. And we'd be out there, and it's Marlo and Lily. Oh, and everybody's coming around, and we say, Bella's coming. She's going to speak here, and you know, and we're trying to get. Pretty soon, here comes the car with Bella in it. The door flies open. Bella didn't stop for anybody, and here she comes out of the car just like a ton of bricks, and with her hat on, and there she always wore a big hat, you know, and pushing people aside. We'd have to run behind her, and you know, she's doing a big run. She wants to tell everybody, you know, and she's so great and everything, but they're like, they've been just run over. Oh, she was dynamite, really.
So you think now, do you think that's a good thing or a bad thing that it's so, that you feel like it's not as much of an issue?
No, I think it is an issue. But, you know, movements supersede others, and then the others come in behind and sweep under. Like the gay movement has been very powerful in the last 10 years. And they've made incredible, you know, progress, I think, knowing where we've come from. It's just like suddenly having a black president in the White House.
Yeah.
For that 40 years from Martin Luther King to Obama, although you can see the backlash then, the people who, the racism and the real fear and dislike of somebody who's different really starts to rear its head. I mean, so some of that happens, the women's movement, you know, a lot of progress is made, and then you got to fight a certain backlash. I'm not even sure how to speak to it, you know, because I've lived it for so many decades. And things like, you know, one of the fallouts of feminism, to me, I'm not saying I shouldn't speak as if I know what the doctrine is, because or that I created it. I like that you're sitting here on these people. It's like the Today Show.
You're waving as people walk by.
I got a big sign. And that is, you know, women, girls became more sexually available. I mean, across the board, young girls. I'm talking, you know, 10, 12, 14. We were pretty available, too, I will say. But not the way it is now. You know, girls are just so sexualized in the culture.
Yeah.
And young girls, I'm talking about baby girls.
Yeah.
In no position to make these choices, I don't think. So,
well, it also, particularly with like pageant culture.
Oh my God, yeah, that's gruesome, isn't it? But you know, on another hand, it creates a much more diverse and liberated people, maybe. But it's like the values are so skewed and crazy that I guess it's. I certainly don't want suppression or anything like that. But I hear, you know, there's just too many girls, too many young girls that get used sexually.
Yeah.
You know, because naturally boys, I mean, my God, a 14-year-old boy is ready to stick it anywhere.
Sure.
And I understand that, and I don't, you know, I view him as a kid, too.
Yeah.
But girls have to know, they've got to protect themselves in some way, because I say to Reba the other night, we were doing a show where she was worried that her daughter, she has two kids on the show, a girl and a boy, both teenagers, and the girl has fallen in love with the boy next door. And I said, I can't remember what the joke was, damn it, but it was like, I said, well, the boy leaves his semen here at the house and moves on, and the girl has to bring that semen into the house, and whatever happens, you've got it right here in your house. But nobody, you know, they don't talk about it that way. It's sort of like, that's why the girls have to protect themselves in some way.
Well, you hope that's where parenting comes in.
Well, you hope it, but it doesn't matter. Peer pressure surpasses parenting unless you have such a profoundly enlightened set of parents that I don't know if anybody has them. How can you? You've got human beings. You're trying to keep going in the culture. It's just a huge morass of confusion and turmoil and
uncertainty. There's not just peer pressure at school now with a handful of kids. Now it's the entire global collection of people is peer pressure.
Yeah, look at these two boys and this poor girl. And why, whatever possessed them to take photographs and put it on the internet? And then where did this disconnect come that they would urinate on this girl?
Oh my God.
Just because she's out of it. But so much crap is accepted, and you know, that's freedom of speech, freedom of what? I don't know, but we got to have it, but then we got it. Like you said, we need some kind of universal parenting that helps you help your kids.
Maybe that's where the Matrix steps in. Maybe the Matrix isn't such a bad idea if it can sort of temper some. Yeah.
I want a new thing. I want Mutter Goddess.
What's that?
Like, you know, Mutter Goddess, and she'll kind of tell benevolently, try to help. Try to help everybody come to some kind of understanding.
All right,
some
but
kind
are
of
we putting an umlaut in this? No?
Maybe this is a...
Yeah, we are. We're putting an umlaut in it, actually.
This is a good character. I think this is a good character, like a good, benevolent... I think there's comedy in there. I think there's comedy in that character.
Yeah, okay, I'm going to do it.
Like this earth...
That phrase, actually, that was a character that Jane had written for us, a project she'd worked on a long time ago, but Mutter Goddess has always stayed with me. And we kind of saw Linda Hunt... as Mutter Goddess.
Yeah. But I think this wise loving,
totally loving,
totally
embracing.
Loving.
No, not the judgment is not, you know, the judgment is more of an embrace. It's like, you know, tender.
It's tender, but it's also it's scolding in a tender way.
Yeah.
And like this is not why I gave you this earth to do these things. And why are you, you know, she's almost maybe almost on the edge of a little passive aggressive, but so lovely. I think there's a fun bit of comedy there.
You know, I'm just flashing on stuff that's in that play. I'm going to go back to that. I'm going to pull some choice thing. It's many years ago. We haven't looked at it since then.
Do it up. Dude.
That's awesome. I'm glad I got to be present
you
for this.
See, this is where how, now. See, this is an example of what how something springs up and just gets on the radar, blips up, and you say it's a revelation.
But isn't that fun that you can have stuff in front of you for years, and then you kind of you're sifting over it and over it, and then one day you go, oh my God, why didn't I, that idea, what was I thinking?
Yeah, I agree. Yes, it's wonderful.
Maybe you just weren't ready yet, or I don't know what it is, but it's nice. It's nice to be able to do that, and it's lovely.
Well, I'm glad I'm going to keep, this will be a bond between us.
Do we have a bond now?
Yeah, you'll see and you'll say, you know, I was there. I'm the one that suggested to her.
I'll stand up in the middle of the show and say that to everyone.
Yeah.
Just like a parent. Everyone, this is a...
No, every time I do Mutter Goddess, I say, Mutter Goddess, Mutter Goddess. Thank you, Chris. Mutter
Goddess. Why does she keep doing that? I listen to this podcast.
You know, I drank this whole cup of coffee. I am flying.
You are? You're super...
Have I been talking faster and faster
no,
and faster?
No, not at all.
Well, I feel like I have.
You want one more hour. Let's go.
We can start running laps around. Okay, come on, guys.
Well,
we're going to solve the world's
you're
problem.
You're awful easy to talk to.
Well, I really appreciate that. And we are kind of at the end of our time, but I really could talk to you for all day, but I don't want to dominate
no,
your
No, let's
time.
Save some of it for...
We'll save some of it for... Please come back on.
Okay.
Would you come back
I
on?
I would love to come back on.
Oh, my gosh.
I have no idea that we're really talking to lots of people.
Yeah, I know. It doesn't.
I think we're just kind of hanging out.
It yeah, shouldn't feel
next
like
next time, let's have beer.
Oh, my gosh.
I'm on board.
Sounds good to me.
All right. Well, it's really been fun. Thanks a lot.
Thanks, Lily Tomlin. Enjoy your burrito, everyone. They said, no, I can't have you. No.
What? Tell me what?
It's a
promo the show?
No, not promo. We tell people to enjoy their burrito at the end of the show.
Oh, I see.
And the fan part of me is... I've been trying to play it cool this whole time, but you know,
Lily, Chris won't ask, but could you possibly just say "Enjoy your burrito" to our
like, is Edith or someone?
I mean, if you wanted to, fine.
Yes, everybody, just enjoy your burrito, and that's the truth.
I need to be sedated now.
Awesome. Give me that burrito, kid.
That was great.
Okay, well, that was fun, you guys.
Beautiful.
Thanks a lot.
Now leaving Nerdist.com. Enjoy your burrito.